Welcome to Go Ask Allie, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
Don't think that there's some one soulmate. It's not like there's one.
Although Bon Jovi is my soulmate.
There's always exceptions.
Are you saying that gossiping is the same as if I'm picking lice out of your scalp and eating it?
Well, you've done both. So what do you think?
I don't want to give her too much. I don't like her to come in with an inflated head.
So we won't mention the Golden Globe.
After all we've been through, we deserve an orgasm, sis.
Honey,
we deserve.
I know. Welcome to Go Ask Allie. I'm Allie Wentworth, and this season I'm digging into everything I can get my hands on, peeling back the layers and getting dirty. And on this episode, I'm talking about what it means to be a feminist, how to be a feminist, and certainly how to raise our girls to be empowered. I grew up with a pretty feminist mother, and I remember in 1976, to celebrate the bicentennial, my mother put together an exhibit called Remember the Ladies. And it was so impactful to me because it was about all the wives of the founding fathers and how the women were behind the scenes and the strength of everything that was accomplished. For example, Abigail Adams wrote almost all of John Adams' speeches. But of course, the women were never recognized. But this exhibit, which went around all over the country, was the first time I kind of woke up and thought, wow, you know, women don't get the recognition that they deserve. And I have the news on behind me, which is showing everything that's going on with Roe versus Wade, Mississippi. I have friends crying their eyes out. And I'm sitting here wondering certainly how my mother charted these waters, but also my two young daughters who are going to enter this world as strong females, and how are they going to navigate everything that we're experiencing right now? So this couldn't be a more perfect guest. Rebecca Traister is an award-winning author and opinion writer covering women in politics, media, and entertainment from a feminist perspective. She's the author of the New York Times best-selling books Good and Mad, All the Single Ladies, and the award-winning Big Girls Don't Cry. She appears as a political commentator on MSNBC and has been featured on The Daily Show, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, Full Frontal with Samantha Bee, and Real Time with Bill Maher. All right, Rebecca Traister, I'm just going to start by saying that this is a big day. We're not going to get into it, I think, until the very end, but with Roe versus Wade, it's a historic moment right now. And so there's no better guest to have on today to talk about feminism than you and how to be a feminist now. And I do want to start very quickly with one of your books. You had an Alice Walker poem, which is one of my favorites, which is, "The feminine is not dead, nor is she sleeping. Angry, yes. Seething, yes. Biding her time, yes, yes." I love that. So I wanted to start with that.
That is a beautiful poem.
Oh, God, I love her. I love her. All right. So here we are. I'm going to ask you sort of a big, broad question, which is, and this is really a personal question, how can I be a feminist now?
Oh, you start on the place that's hardest for me to answer. It's very interesting because so much of the work that I do is analysis, not prescription. But what I find over and over again is that what people want is prescription, right? I actually really understand this hunger because I feel it too, to know what choices to make.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple things that I would say when it comes to these sort of questions about what to do right now. But the sort of biggest prescriptive thing that I can say is that a lot of contemporary feminism, especially as it has been embodied and expressed, especially by a lot of the middle-class white women, has so often been about expression, right? This is like, how do I raise my voice? How do I use my voice, right? And increasingly over the years that I've been writing about feminism and political and ideological engagement in the project of making the country a more just place for more people, what I've come to understand that especially for those of us who come to this conversation with degrees of power, so much of what we need to do moving forward is not about our own expression, but about our own reception, right? So that means listening, but not in that kind of like, listen to others, like actual active listening, looking around us, not just to our own experiences, though our own experiences often offer us guides and entry points to these conversations, right? I don't want to diminish our own experience as a way that many of us have come to these conversations, but like, it's not necessarily about us. Like, it's about a lot of people. It's about working as part of a coalition. So what do you have to do to be part of a coalition? The most important thing that those who are coming to a conversation about power imbalances and who are coming to that conversation on behalf of people who are at the margins of power is to understand that in order to make progress from the margins, you have to be part of a coalition.
Right.
And being a part of a coalition means not just expressing, but receiving and working in tandem with other people, which means listening, learning about the history you don't know, learning about the people that you don't know, learning about the stories that you don't know.
When you talk about coalition building, you're talking about sort of building a coalition with other people that have experience being on the lesser side of power. So it's not just about being a woman. It's about being Black in our country. It's about being any kind of marginalized group in our country.
Right. So in terms of this question of what does it mean to be in coalition with other people, that can take a million different forms, right? There's also this sense that the only form of protest is like what we have been told is, you know, like marching, right? But in fact, being in coalition with others and the beginning steps of organizing, whether that means politically or professionally, sometimes the entry points are our own frustrations, or sometimes it's initially seeing someone else's frustrations or inequity or injustice. But, you know, it could mean you feel that there is some form of just injustice at your workplace that you're experiencing or that a colleague is experiencing. And there's actually peril in you directly confronting a boss about it, right? The peril of job loss, of retaliation, whatever. And so a coalition can involve reaching out to and listening to other colleagues who may be experiencing similar frustrations or related, different but related frustrations based on power imbalances or things that are dysfunctional at their office. And maybe that leads to some broader like labor organizing, right? Like a unionizing effort. Or maybe it's simply finding a network of support and community to come up with strategies within your workplace to find a way to address the inequities that provides the safety of numbers, right? Then, of course, we have the more, you know, traditional ones, going to meetings in your neighborhood, getting involved in terms of community activism, local politics, something that we've seen a lot of people get into, especially and unfortunately only after the 2016 election, where you suddenly had people who'd been totally uninterested in politics until then, suddenly, like, and this is a good thing, right? Suddenly realizing that their town had a sheriff, right? And that people had died in their local jails, mm-hmm. and that things that they didn't even know, even though it was happening down the street from them, that came from being in coalition with other people who had been active and awake to these things and on the ground for years. And it was, that's part of listening within a coalition, is finding yourself shoulder to shoulder with people and listening to what they have to tell you.
Well, as indicative of when Trump was in power, and when you think about when we were all in lockdown, the movements that started to really get traction, like Black Lives Matter, there was a lot of activism happening at the same time. I mean, I feel like people built upon a coalition in the past couple of years. Would you agree with that?
I do, although I want to point out that there were lots of people who were unsurprised by the levels of racism and misogyny and sort of corporate manipulation of power structures that were evidence made manifest by the election of Donald Trump, right? There were millions of people who've been doing this work for their entire lives. It's really like people whose daily existences had not yet felt an impact from those realities, who were surprised to learn these things, and then did exactly this, like started to do some work, right? We're like, oh, I want to march. I want to get out there and show how angry I am. And there's a lot to be said about the Women's March and the impact that it had both on in its initial form and then its next year and on. But one of the really important things about that is that it was taken over and run by activists who had been very engaged in a lot of fights, and not necessarily fights around gender inequity, right? And they insisted on the form that that massive protest took, which was a historic, like at that time, the biggest single day protest in the history of the United States. And of course, it spanned the globe. And the organizers insisted that the people who were coming there as new to a fight were going to be standing there shoulder to shoulder and hearing about whether they chose to absorb it and to listen or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
From people who had been in fights for more liberty and more dignity for more people over decades when a lot of the new people had not been paying attention. And so then once you got this new population, a population that also has access to a lot more power, resources, engaged, there was listening from coalition, at least to some degree, and there was learning about systemic racism.
Mm-hmm.
These are the years in which we have revised views of American history coming not just around questions of gender inequity, which we have around Me Too, but also the 1619 Project, published initially in the New York Times, Ta-Nehisi Coates' work in The Atlantic about reparations, the view of how these forces didn't just erupt. In the past 5 years, Trump was a symptom of forces that have shaped this country since before its official inception.
Right. And the people that have been fighting for decades were not surprised at all by this.
Right.
It was everybody else that was catching up. I want to go back a little bit to Hillary, because for somebody on the sidelines watching that election, I was mortified, first of all, by how she was treated, but by how it was allowed, you know, weaponizing of words. I still get upset when I think about it, how the threat of a female president and the rage, it was like a tidal wave of, for me, of fear, and nobody was sort of speaking up and saying, you can't treat this woman like this. You can't say hang her or shoot her or all the kinds of things that were being said at the time. And it kind of happened and then it went away.
So it comes as a surprise to a lot of people, not just you, that they say hang her and she should be taken out and shot, and that there are parades, as I saw in my, you know, a town where I spend a lot of time, of like Hillary in a coffin on the 4th of July. Just violent imagery. And then this sort of sexualized denigration of Hillary. It comes as a real shock, like a bracing shock. And yet the thing that's invisible that we don't think about is actually we've never had a female president before. Why? Right? So the inverse is invisible, right? So it's like we tell ourselves stories all the time about being in a post-feminist world in which the very fact that Hillary Clinton can exist means that, you know, whatever stupid phrase about women can have it all is, you know, is being tossed around. And yet, if you actually look at the history of who's been president in the United States, that list is entirely white men minus one and all men. And yet we're surprised when the fact that there's an attempt by one to become president, a legitimate attempt, and in fact, she wins more votes than her opponent, and she is greeted with that level of rage. If that level of rage and hatred and denigration didn't exist, we would have had a lot more women running our political systems. We don't.
But even when you look at the female senators and congresswomen and the amount of stuff that they've gotten done, the stuff that a lot of women in political positions have pushed through is enormous. And yet we don't look at that at all. We don't look at their success as something that could be a national success.
Right. Well, I think it's more that so much of this country is built around a normalizing and imagining a full humanity of one kind of person. And it still is a
white man,
male, straight,
yeah,
cis, probably wealthy-ish person, right?
Yeah.
And like that's, and that applies in every facet of our lives. Like the, you know, the books that we read, that doesn't mean that we're not completely surrounded all the time by like brilliant, inspiring, sometimes high achieving, sometimes very powerful people who are not white men, right? There's a difference between there being exceptions, even tons of exceptions, millions of exceptions,
mm-hmm,
and there being still attitudes that are baked into how we are raised from birth, what is broadcast to us on television and on the internet and in our conversations and at bars and, you know, over our dinner tables, about who we have been taught can be a full human being and who we are taught naturally has power in this country. And whenever there is a challenge to those baked in assumptions, people react really aggressively in ways that still manage to surprise us. And yet we're absorbing all those lessons every day ourselves, you know?
Yes. And it's time for a short break. Okay, let's get back to it. So let me ask you a question. It's 1991, and you're in Maine, and you're watching the Anita Hill trial, Was that like the big pivotal moment that, quote unquote, got you angry, that got you sort of involved, taking this road as opposed to being a makeup influencer?
I was never going to be a makeup influencer.
Oh, you don't know, Rebecca. But I'm saying that was the moment, right?
In retrospect, I would say that was a moment of shifted consciousness for me. I have written about this story. My mother was raised on a potato farm in northern rural Maine in a very right-wing family. And I was up there. I was very close to my grandparents. And I was in high school. And I was up on that fall weekend in October of 1991 making apple cider at my grandparents' farm. And the Anita Hill hearings were on. And they were very Republican. And they despised her. My parents were, my dad came from a family of like Jewish socialists from the Bronx, and my mother's politics had shifted when she was in college. And so I'd grown up in a left-leaning household, but it's not like I was an at-the-barricades kid at all. I thought about these issues, I cared about politics, but I was not an activist high school student or anything like that. And I was sitting at that table watching those hearings, and it would be totally dishonest for me to tell a version of that story where after that, then I went out and got involved in activism. That absolutely did not happen. It is, however, the moment that I know the impact that it had on my brain and my sensibilities because I remember every second of it with such clarity. I feel like those hearings carved my brain, right? In a way that didn't immediately change my behavior. You know?
Right.
But it made visible to me some of this stuff that we're talking about that's just invisible. Had I ever really thought prior to that about the fact that a Senate Judiciary Committee that was going to decide who sits on the Supreme Court was made up entirely of white men, at least one of whom, who is the great left-wing hero of my youth, Ted Kennedy, couldn't open his mouth because he himself had such a fucked up history?
Yeah.
And because his nephew was at that point on trial for rape in Florida, like, okay. And I lived every day in this country and I did care about politics. I read the newspaper. It wasn't that I was disengaged.
Right.
And then those hearings, it was the beginning of like how I now understand the world, which provides clarity for me as just a constant interlocking power structure. Right. And those hearings made absolutely clear to me for the first time in a way that would later absolutely shape my thinking as I began to write about this professionally, how power worked around gender and race. And so that's how it galvanized me. But it's not like, oh, I watched those hearings and then I went out and changed my life. That was not the case.
Right. You didn't paint a sign right after.
I certainly did not.
It's interesting you say that because I have two teenage daughters and we were watching the Kavanaugh hearing together. And I saw my, at the time, 16-year-old daughter get enraged and furious and asking George and I all kinds of questions about how is this okay? And how is he still there? You know, and I feel like you get re-angered when you have kids that start seeing the world the way you did a while ago. And you talk about this a lot. Sometimes it's a lens through righteousness and how do we fix it? And then there's like an overload fatigue, which I feel that a lot of women are feeling now, which is like, I can't, it's too much. It's too much. And we have a pandemic and Trump might be president again. I'm taking to my bed and I'm taking Xanax.
Well, so there's things to fear from wins and losses, especially for the newly engaged, right? Because with losses, and I've been thinking about this week as, you know, it seems, I mean, we won't know, but like, very, very likely that Roe will be overturned this session, which I spent my life being told like would never happen and that it was hysterical that I was arguing that it was imperiled. But with losses comes that feeling that you're describing, especially for those who don't have experience with losses. And I actually had a really fascinating experience of this. In the fall of 2018, I published a book about women's anger, and it was a historical look, but it was written in the 2 years between Trump's win and the midterms. And I wrote it very quickly. And it tracked the sort of form that this new engagement in politicized anger took for a lot of women on the very roughly defined left. And when it was published, it happened to be the week of the Kavanaugh hearings. Okay. So much of the story that I was writing was actually a story of, in that very short, compressed period, a series of surprise wins, if not full wins, like ways that those who were very new to the public expression of anger, new to the very notion of working within coalitions of marginalized people, like they're going to have a women's march, and it was massive. And out of the women's march came coalitions of new candidates who were winning primaries at unprecedented rates against incumbents. You had, obviously, the hashtag MeToo movement, and powerful people lost their jobs. All this stuff where it was this sense of like, wait, if we're really engaged, we really can make change. And there were these sort of, in that period, small iterations of victories that, of course, feel good and energizing. And especially because so many of the people who were new to these kinds of fights were coming from relatively privileged climes, right? Where there is a sense of power.
Yeah.
Like if I put my mind to it, if I put my money to it, I can make a change. I can get what I want. Like steps forward and like a sense of gratification. Like it really mattered that I marched. It really mattered that I gave that speech in front of my school board. It really mattered that I told the story of harassment because so there was a consequence. There was something happened because of it. And that is really energizing for people. And then my book was published the week of the Kavanaugh hearings and, you know, they lost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? And so many of those women were out screaming and saying, this can't happen. It can't happen. And then it happened. He was confirmed. Right?
Yeah.
And I was out there on a book tour talking to people who were like, I don't even want to get out of bed. I lost. And one of the hardest things to absorb for those who are new to these kinds of fights, again, if we won all of them, we wouldn't be here, right? Mm-hmm. That so much of this work, so much of what it means to be engaged, to be awake, as opposed to sort of asleep and unconscious of the amount of injustice that's in the world, so much of it and staying engaged means losing over and over and over again.
To the point where we might not even see our victories in our lifetime.
Let me tell you, we will surely not, Allie.
Right.
Right?
I know.
It's one of the things I've really been looking at this week. And but this is really important for people here. I'm not going to live to see Roe reinstated. I mean, and that is like, this is dumb. This is dumb to cry about because you know what? Generations of people gave their entire, with way less power than me, okay? And way less comfort than me, who gave their lives, right? For voting rights.
Yeah.
For reproductive rights. Mm-hmm. For labor protections. Mm-hmm. For environmental protections. All of which are being stripped back right now because of the sort of inattentions of institutional power structures, including, in my mind, a Democratic Party and the political press, right? The inattention to the gravity of what was at stake here over the past seven decades, okay? But centuries worth of people gave their entire lives' energies to these fights and sustained loss after loss after loss after loss and died with no expectation that there would be a win anytime soon. And when those rights and protections were finally won, they would never have been won had those people not given their lifetimes to that fight, right? And there are many people alive right now who live through the victories. And I think that the horror for them of having happened to be born and devoted themselves to the fight at a moment where they got to see victory, like I have witnessed, you know, what it feels like to win, to gain greater liberation. And a tiny bit more justice. But a lot of what I, as somebody who's born in 1975, am going to live through is the erosion of those victories. And yeah, the temptation to be like, okay, I'm going back to bed. And especially for those who can live a comfortable life. And again, this is a lot of the people who are new to these fights can go back to not caring, right? It's more comfortable that way. It's a lot less sad. And it's a lot less horrifying.
Yeah. The other thing I want to add right now is that I've also noticed where when you think about reproductive rights, there's a huge amount of people that no matter what, weren't even getting the accessibility in the first place that still won't.
So much of what we have understood even about the history of Roe, there's been this sense that, well, as Roe stands, abortion is legal, but that is a fraction of the story, and that has been true for decades. The Hyde Amendment, which is a legislative rider that prohibits the use of government insurance programs like Medicaid from paying for abortion care, and which was first passed in 1976, I think went into effect in 1980, has meant that for millions of Americans, abortion was all but illegal and inaccessible And that's been true since just a few years after abortion was legalized, right?
Exactly.
There's a vast chasm between legality and accessibility. Then you add to that the thousands of restrictions, narrowing of possibility in states around the country. You add to that the kind of violent vilification of those who require abortion care and those who provide it, clinic bombings, providers being shot and killed, creating atmospheres of intense danger in lots of areas in this country. What that has meant is that over the years that Roe has officially stood and abortion has officially been legal and safe, it has in fact been unsafe, in many places illegal, and in many, many places inaccessible, especially for the most vulnerable communities, especially for women of color, for poor women, for immigrants, for young people, for people in rural areas, for people in red states. And that has been true through my entire lifetime. And yet there hasn't been the seriousness of like, wait, these are people's lives at stake. It's the shape of their existence, it's their dignity, their humanity, their well-being. That has not been at the center of the conversation of millions of us who officially like support abortion rights and access. And the other thing I want to say that this is where the reproductive justice movement has been brilliant, and too few on the left, again, whether you're the Democratic Party, some of its strains of activism, has not been good at making the very obvious and true case that, in fact, abortion policy cannot be separated from questions of literal infrastructure, of housing equality, of social safety nets, the ability of families to eat, to get enough food, to have decent benefits, to have good, strong unemployment benefits, to have good education systems, safe housing, a just criminal justice system that enable families across economic spectrum to make any kinds of choices. The framework of choice being just about abortion, which is a framework that I think is very flawed and lots of people understand is flawed, doesn't even begin to get at the number of factors and the number of interwoven policies that have been in place. And it hasn't permitted the cogent argument that should always have been made. And of course, some people are making it, but you don't have a Democratic Party making it, which is if you have an anti-abortion right-wing party that is arguing about the sanctity of life and forcing people to have children, carry pregnancies to term, and yet not requiring that they get protected paid leave from their jobs, not requiring that there's any form of subsidized daycare for those children who are brought into the world, not, you know, building up a safety net where people have good SNAP benefits and increased access to food or to clean water or to good, strong educational systems, right? You don't do any of those things. None of those things are being advocated. In fact, they're being fought against by the same people who are talking about the sanctity of life and the preciousness of every child, and yet oppose the policies that would make life safer, kinder, more dignified. It's right-wing hypocrisy, but it's also a left-wing failure to understand and to communicate to voters and to would-be activists and to human beings that these things are all interconnected and that they're a moral imperative for those in the Democratic Party and on the left. That's a failure of the Democratic Party.
There you go. And we'll be right back. Great, let's get back to it. I'm going to quickly switch gears here only because there's so many things I want to talk to you about. I want to get to the Me Too movement because one of the things I've noticed in social media is that there's a feeling of if I post something, that's my activism. It pulls us away from the marches and the school board meetings and the community get-togethers because we can just put a post or a quote and call it a day, and that's being active. And so I'm wondering how you're feeling about the Me Too movement right now, because it had a moment. Yes, Harvey Weinstein went to jail, but ultimately, what does that mean?
Nothing. Doesn't mean a lot, actually.
But yeah, no, nothing. I should preface by saying that I was watching the Charlie Rose and the Matt Lauer, as I'm married to a journalist, you know, he's sort of the last man standing right now. And so it was sort of an interesting time to be watching everything from my bed, so to speak. Unpack that, Rebecca.
We're going to start with the bed.
Okay.
Okay. You know, it was always going to be a moment. I was shocked by how long the moment lasted. At the time, it was like, I couldn't believe, I think I wrote at the time that it was like a window had opened into which everybody could suddenly yell and through which everybody could see, like, and it was like, oh my God. And I expected it to shut immediately. And I could not believe when sort of October moved into November, moved into December, moved into January, and still people were telling their stories. And if you were a journalist who was covering this, the thing that you knew, and I've described this before as kind of like, because you know, there was a period in my reporting life, I wasn't reporting the breaking news about it at the time. I was doing analysis of it, but I was writing about these topics. And I was getting anywhere from between 10 and 100 emails every day in that period with stories from people, some of them about very famous people and some of them about teachers and parents and relatives and friends who had abused or assaulted or hurt or harassed. And the view from where I was like a horror movie. And it was like dipping your head beneath the surface of the ocean and feeling both like suffocated and getting a view of how big the iceberg is underneath what's visible on top. It was horrible. But I was also shocked by how much of that iceberg became visible above the surface, right? Like it was, I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe there was a sustained appetite for it. I couldn't believe because it's so uncomfortable to hear. It's uncomfortable for all of us. It's uncomfortable. The stories were ugly. They were painful. And they also implicated all of us, every single one of us in one way or another. And I wrote a lot about that at the time. But I always knew, everybody I knew who cared deeply about these issues and these inequities also understood that A, it was a moment, and B, that there would be a tremendously powerful backlash to that. And the question for me looking right at this moment is, how long is it going to last? I don't know the answer to that. I could see it unfolding in a lot of ways. This question that you asked about posting is really interesting to me because I actually am very open to there being a million different forms of activism for millions of different people, right? I don't necessarily think that going to meetings or engaging in street protest is the right fit for everybody. I think for whom those engagements are the right fit, who have the resources to participate in them, should be doing them, and that's like a moral imperative. The key is being engaged in a way that makes sense, right? And that's going to depend on your community, your economic position, your nature, right? How you communicate, mm-hmm. the ease you feel in certain situations. Because activism will not be sustainable if it's a matter of trying to fit yourself into a path that isn't right for you, right? If you hate doing it, you're not going to stay engaged and you're going to turn around.
Right, right.
So all that is to say that I actually have like, I have a lot more openness in my view to say some of the people who get pretty seriously mocked for like putting those signs in their yards, you know, like this home, whatever there is. I actually think that that kind of thing in communities that are really red and restrictive can actually be a meaningful form of signaling solidarity. Mm-hmm. And that signaling solidarity is powerful. It's always been powerful. That's how political campaigns work. It's how activism works. Is you have hats, you have trinkets.
Yeah.
So I'm much less cynical about that stuff. Here's where the problem is. It's when people who have resources to be doing other things are just posting. Posting can be meaningful depending on the context of the community you're posting from, right?
Right.
So again, in a very restrictive community, the act of posting can be explosive and you know, perilous, perhaps socially perilous, right? In ways that I don't want to just say posting is meaningless. It's not. But if all you're doing is posting and all you're doing is posting to people who already agree with you when you could be doing something else, and maybe that something else is, again, like there's no one form of activism that fits. Maybe that something else is reading. I say this a lot. And it actually goes back to your first question about what to do as a feminist right now. For me, one of the most changing, spurring, galvanizing acts is to learn the history that has preceded us, to seek the stories that you haven't been told, which is different from seeking your own research on vaccines. Don't do that. But seek the... We are not taught the history of the struggles from the margins in our school books, right? So it can be genuinely reading and learning history, watching good documentaries about things, learn about a labor movement, which is completely entwined with a women's movement.
Yep.
Learn about the history of the women's movement, the abolition movement, which were both entwined and then brutally like severed by racism within the women's movement in the 19th century, learn about, I mean, there's so much out there that we haven't been taught. And that in itself can help steer you toward things. Maybe it is. Maybe your participation will be through a sort of workplace unionizing effort, or maybe it will be at a community center. Maybe it will be through doing rape crisis stuff or working for your community's community aid group. Like, who knows? But a lot of it can be shaped, and your approaches and your understanding of the dynamics around you and within your own communities can be shaped by that reading.
It also is, I mean, all these things you're saying, especially the volunteering stuff, is especially if it's an authentic want, you know, to be educated on real history, to, you know, participate, then it can be very effective.
Yes. Yes. Well, and so that's what I'm saying. If you're coming from a place where you have time, resources, money, capability, energy, and a desire to be engaged, and what you're doing is posting, then that is problematic, right?
Yeah.
That's what I would say about the posting. And so that is, yes, go read. It can be incredible. Like, read and then talk. Talk with your family, talk with your friends, talk with your coworkers. Like, you will find, if you start reading about this stuff, that the history itself will surprise you, will probably enrage you.
And embarrass you.
Embarrass you and inspire you to make a future that's different from the past, right?
Like, yeah.
And then to share that, you can be inspired to then in turn talk about that and share those stories with the people around you. That's part of community engagement. It's part of coalition. That also goes back to my point about listen to other people's stories, right? Are you mad about something? Go out and seek people who are mad about related things. And also listen to them if part of what they're mad about is you. That's a really important thing, I think, especially for middle-class white women, is to understand that if you're mad, right? Good, correct. But there are probably people out there who are mad at you. And that doesn't necessarily, like, and maybe for reasons that are good or bad or whatever, but like, listen to that. Take it seriously. Take it with the seriousness that you want your anger to be heard.
So, you know, as I said before, I have two teenage daughters, and I find that a lot of women, we're trying to figure out how to empower our daughters and, like you said before, have them finish our unfinished business. What can our daughters do, and our sons? What can the next generations do to kind of push the wagon up the hill?
I do have two kids. I have two kids who are younger. They're daughters. And I have thought a lot about it because I do think that there's this sense of like that the project is empowerment. This goes back to what we were talking about how, especially amongst middle-class white women, it often all the advice boils down to like using your voice, expression, empowerment. And the one thing I will say is that I have become increasingly disenchanted with that line of advice, especially, you know, in middle-class families where young people, white boys and girls, are going to have access to certain kinds of power. And I think that doesn't mean that you want to replicate the messages of, you know, diminution and degradation that do get foisted on white women, right? That's real, mm-hmm. right? There are all kinds of ways in which misogyny plays itself out on white women, but often, in fact, to get them to serve and dependent on white patriarchal forces. So you want to keep your kids of all genders aware of the inequalities in the world and be straight with them without being performatively self-flagellating about the degrees of power that they have and where they need to fight for more power. And be real clear about that, that it's not a simple equation. Right? That it's not just about, I'm going to send you out into the world to fight for your own power. It's about actually beginning from a very early age to encourage them to work alongside and for other people whose voices have been less valued historically. And in a contemporary world, it's about teaching them not only to use their own voices, which sure, yes,
yeah,
but also to listen to the voices around them. It's about teaching them not to rear back from anger, their own, or the anger of those around them who they perceive are experiencing injustice. It's about teaching them to be clear-eyed about how power works and how they profit from it and benefit from it and how they need to fight for more of it, not only for themselves, but for those who are more at the margins. How you do that via, like, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
Now, what do you think of the term Karen?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, it's a good question. I don't have a great answer for it.
I'll be the judge of that.
It certainly expresses, you know, what I just talked about, because part of what I'm talking about is not just the anger between tribal opposites, but between allies. You know, Audre Lorde very famously wrote about the uses of anger and the generative power of anger between people who are ideologically aligned, between Black women and white women. So I think Karen is a character and a caricature of a figure who does produce frustration for very legitimate reasons. That said, it is also any time that you're trafficking in a cartoon, you are invariably trading on stereotypes, and that's very true too.
Right.
And that it doesn't make the grievances any less real, right? There is a reason that character exists. That said, would it be better and sharper and more honest if we didn't traffic in cartoon characters? Probably. But there's also a reason, like, I once wrote in my first book about 2008 that the best distillation of the dynamics around Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin came from a Saturday Night Live sketch, which I still believe to be true, the Tina Fey and Amy Poehler sketch.
Yeah.
Because cartoons convey truth, and they also convey bias.
As does comedy, yes.
Right, yeah. So there's not an easy answer. Karen's a cartoon. And therefore, Karen conveys some serious truths.
Mm-hmm.
She's also a cartoon. There is also the critique, which I take seriously, which is that the focus on the failings and the racism and blinkered issues of white women very often does wind up leaving white men off the hook. It happens all the time.
100%, yes.
But to say that doesn't take away from the reality of why, and in fact, it's often because it's white women who think that as women, they belong in a more vulnerable or aggrieved category than men, and yet replicate and profit from the very biases they'd like to present themselves as standing against. So that's why the cartoon exists and why it's so effective. If it wasn't effective, we wouldn't be talking about it.
Oh, good answer. Now ask me something. You can ask me a question about everything.
Oh, well, I mean, this is, gosh, you know, what's the last book you read?
Oh, a book called Secret City.
What is it?
Which is about the history of gay Americans in every administration.
Oh, wow. That's a good answer.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, could have said Marie Claire, but no. but Secret City. It's fascinating how many gay or closeted people kind of informed policy and made decisions and yet had to stay in the shadows, so to speak. And these are real policymakers and real people that were, you know, the right hand to many, many, many presidents. So I thought it was fascinating.
It's great. I haven't read it.
Yeah. Rebecca, thank you so much. There's 8 million things to talk to you about, but I'm so happy to have had this time with you to talk about feminism and everything else.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
If you haven't read Rebecca's book, Good and Mad, do yourself a favor and get yourself a copy. And now to my daughters, I hope that they are listening, and I hope that they're paying attention, and I hope that they will listen and pay attention to people that don't have a voice right now. I think a lot of what Rebecca said is so important for future generations. And now I'd like to end this podcast of Go Ask Allie with an Abigail Adams quote. Do not put such unlimited power into the hands of the husbands. Remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation. Thank you for listening to Go Ask Allie. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, and follow me on social media. On Twitter at Allie E. Wentworth, and on Instagram at The Real Allie Wentworth. And if you have questions or guest suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. Call or text me at 323-364-6356 or email goaskalliepodcast@gmail.com. Go Ask Allie is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.